Welcome to Hour 2 of Dark Matters Radio with my very special guest, Mr. Michael Cremo. If you are just now joining us, we have been discussing his earth-shattering and science-astounding bestseller, Forbidden Archaeology. If you're just joining us also, this is what I suggest you do while you're listening to this show. Get on your computer, go up to www.forbiddenarchaeology.com. You can read all about Mr. Cremo. You can read about his best-selling book, about the firestorm that it ignited throughout the world in the scientific community, and his new book, Human Deevolution, which we're going to be covering also in this hour. But Michael, before we had to go to break at the top of the hour, you were discussing the ancient Sanskrit writings. I had asked the question about technological marvels that could not be explained through mainstream scientific, and you very correctly pointed out that some of these technological advances just, quite frankly, wouldn't survive thousands or hundreds of thousands or even millions of years in the ground. But these writings suggest that there was advanced technology.
Yes, and I think a new generation of researchers could actually start looking for such evidence in the layers of the earth. Scientists tend to find what they're looking for, and I think at the present moment, nobody's really looking for really high-tech kinds of objects in the very ancient layers of the earth. I think if we started looking for it and started thinking, well, what would a computer look like after 10 million years, we might start getting some reports that such things actually did exist.
Okay, what about the ancient Sanskrit writings, the ancient Vedic traditions out of primarily India? Now, they, and I've got to admit, I am not as familiar with those as probably I should be. I know you're an expert on that, but they have discussed in their writings flying machines, Vimanas, with technological marvels such as advanced weaponry. You know, that's something also that I wanted to broach with you. You're talking about these ancient advanced beings, peoples. Some have suggested that, in fact, they may have been extraterrestrials. Others have suggested that, no, they were simply advanced humans with technologies that today we're only rediscovering. But they seem as warlike as we are today.
Some of them, yes. I think there wasn't one type of human-like being existing in the past on this planet or on other planets. And I think this is something that we get from the modern UFO and contactee and abductee types of reports as well, that some people appear to encounter beings that appear to have peaceful intentions, we might say, and who are interested in helping establish a more peaceful kind of life on Earth. And others appear to have more warlike intentions or hostile intentions. So as far as I can see, there are now and have always been beings of different kinds of mentalities.
Well, the ancient Indian traditions talk about various gods that, for one reason or another, have come into great conflict with other gods, and they have launched, and I forget now because it's been, quite honestly, it's been many years since I've read about that, but they launched weapons that can only be described using today's technological prowess as being atomic weapons. Now, what I found...
Yeah, they're called Brahmastras. That's one of the terms for them.
All right. Brahmastras.
And it's interesting that...
Well, what I wanted to point out is that there have been areas in India that have been discovered that still today have lingering high counts of radiation that are not explainable unless perhaps at some point a nuclear weapon was used.
Yes, things like that can occur. One interesting thing I found was that Robert Oppenheimer, who was one of the heads of the American Manhattan Project that led to the development of the first American atomic bomb,
yes,
was also a student of the ancient Sanskrit writings of India. And when he saw the first atomic bomb tested at Alamogordo, New Mexico, he began reciting ancient Sanskrit verses that describe the effects of kinds of weapons, which he said they make a light greater than that of millions of suns all in the same place and things like that. So pretty amazing this great physicist had an understanding of the accomplishments of previous civilizations.
Now, of course, this would be probably considered scientific well, I don't want to get too crazy, but you know, I happen to be acquainted with and know very well another gentleman that has taken a look at our distant past. I'm sure you may know him, or that you're at least aware of him, Mr. Zachariah Sitchin.
I'm aware of him. I've never met him personally, but I'm aware of his work, yes.
Well, I've known Zachariah for almost 20 years, and I have read all his books and have done a review actually on a number of them, and I've interviewed him in the past, and one of the amazing things that he has apparently discovered, which will slip and slide right in with what you're talking about, is the ancient Sumerian civilization that approximately 2440 or 50 BCE, before the Common Era, absolutely, totally collapsed, that Sitchin credited with these ancient Sumerian Anunnaki, or those who from heaven to earth came. In other words, apparently E.T., had a nuclear war, which today you can still see the effects in Iraq from orbit. Are you familiar with that?
That particular point I'm not familiar with, but I learn something new every day, and I'm happy to learn.
Well, if you get a chance, you ought to read that section in his book, The Lost Book of Enki, which was one of the Sumerian deities that they prayed to. But at any rate, what is the time frame for this nuclear holocaust that took place in India? Are you aware of that?
Well, from what I can see, the Brahmastra weapons were used at different times and places. The most recent recorded evidence for it is the time of the Mahabharata War, which is described in many ancient Sanskrit writings. It took place about 5,000 years ago, according to the traditional accounts.
This would be in the same time frame, Michael.
About 3,000 BC in northwest India.
This would be somewhere within the same time frame.
Yes. I think it's very interesting that if we look not just at the ancient Sanskrit writings, but the writings of other ancient civilizations at that time, they all seem to have a worldview that involves contacts between living beings on Earth and higher beings from either other planets or other levels of reality.
Now, when you say other levels of reality, are you talking about interdimensional?
I would say that. I tend to use the word levels because sometimes if you use the word dimension than people who have a very strict mathematical understanding of the concept of dimension will say you're misusing the term.
But even people like...
So I tend to use the word level, but dimension is something I would also be comfortable with, but there are some... I'm just careful with the terms that I use, because sometimes in scientific circles, you know, you get some objections.
Well, there are physicists that will readily agree that there are at least 11 dimensions.
Yes, some string theorists.
Yes. And some go as high as 20-odd dimensions.
And I find what they say is interesting, but they say only 3 of those dimensions are visible to us, and the other ones are not visible, although they are dimensions where beings could exist, I would say. So yes, I whether we're talking about interdimensional beings or inter-level beings, depending on the terminology that we want to use, yes, I would say that there are things like that, that the universe is not just a vacuum extending as far as it goes. There are other levels, other dimensions, which can be approached by those who have sufficient knowledge and the technology that enables them to go through those different dimensions of time and space.
Well, not to get too far off topic, but you know what I find, speaking about this, what I find so amazing, back in the mid to latter 1950s, when the United States and the Soviet Union were still doing above ground atomic testing, and of course, among segments of the population, there was a great outcry because, I mean, it was fairly well known, the effects of radiation and what have you. But there were people then called contactees in the UFO movement who suggested that extraterrestrials were continually warning the public, or at least these contactees, about the effects of nuclear explosions and what it may be doing to quote unquote people in other dimensions. What do you think about that?
I think that is a valid concern. It's something I think that even from, you know, some of the more recent contactee and abductee reports say there's also, you know, concern in these beings. Express concern that activities on Earth are disturbing others, other beings, and other parts of the cosmos. I think that's true.
You know, in forbidden archaeology, there was one out-of-place thing that was discovered in my home state of Pennsylvania, I believe near Philadelphia. And I'm very quickly looking. I had a series of pages marked here.
Was that the letter-like marks that were found in some limestone quarry?
Marble.
Yes, a marble quarry. Yeah, that was pretty interesting. Yeah, you had these figures, which some people have told me look like letters from the Hebrew alphabet.
It's on page 797 in my edition, yes.
Right. Yes, so those were found in some... the workers in a marble quarry, you know, broke open a layer of rock, and they found these letter-like shapes that looked like letters from a human alphabet. You know, some who saw them and wrote to me that they looked like letters from the Hebrew alphabet.
Now, is this still in existence?
That particular object I have not been able to track down. In my work, I generally try to do that. For example, the California gold mine discoveries. I went to the Phoebe Hearst Museum of Anthropology at the University of California in Berkeley, and I was able to track down some of those objects from the California gold mines. They're still in the collection of that museum, although they're not shown to the public.
Why not?
Well, there could be several reasons for it. Any museum doesn't display everything it has. But these things are kept in a storage building several miles from the museum itself, and I think I think one reason they're not shown is that they just appear to contradict everything that scientists are now telling us about human origins and human antiquity, because these things, if you go by the reports of the original discoverer, Dr. J.D. Whitney, who was the chief government geologist of California, he said in his report, which was published by Harvard University, that these objects came from tertiary formations. And you put that into modern language, you look at the modern geological reports, it means formations that go back to around 50 million years old from these California gold mines. So I think what happened is that back around the time that these objects were originally discovered, there were other scientists who just couldn't accept them, like William Holmes, who was an anthropologist at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington. He said, if Dr. Whitney had understood the theory of human evolution, he wouldn't have published that report about these California gold mine discoveries, because it just doesn't fit the theory. In other words, if the facts didn't fit the theory, then the facts had to be wrong. Usually in science, it should be the other way around. If
yes.
you find facts that contradict your theory, you should modify your theory.
Well, in law enforcement, that's how it works. If the facts, and if you are... And believe me, I have seen this firsthand. If you're running on a preconceived notion and you're discarding the facts, it can end up ultimately biting you on the posterior.
Yeah, absolutely true. I think that I think people are becoming more and more aware of that with these, you know, the popularity of these CSI kinds of programs on television.
Well, Michael, believe it or not, we are up against another break. And God, I really wish we could just run straight through, but we can't. We've got to give our commercial folks a chance to sell their items, and we will be back with my guest, Mr. Michael Cremo. And we are back with Mr. Michael Cremo. His book, Forbidden Archaeology. I cannot stress too much. If you have an interest in any of this material, you owe it to yourself to get a copy. Michael, Forbidden Archaeology, you also had a revised edition?
Well, Forbidden Archaeology is 900 pages long. It's you could say, the Bible of this evidence for extreme human antiquity. But for some people, 900 pages is a little bit too much. So we brought out a shorter edition of the book, about 300 pages long, called The Hidden History of the Human Race. It includes all the original cases, but they're just described in a more compact way, each case.
And these are all available on Amazon?
Yes, they're available on Amazon from my website. There are a lot of ways to get the books from bookstores. They may not have them on the shelves, but they'll be able to order them if they're not on the shelf. So there are a lot of ways for people to get those books. Strangely, I found that most people buy the 900-page book because they don't want to miss anything.
Yes.
You know, but it was a surprise to me, because I thought I did want the book to be available to people who might not want to go through a 900-page book.
Well, you know, when I was doing my old radio program, Strange Days, which was roughly 10 years ago, and once again, I had interviewed you then. My then staff, I will never forget how many people wanted to borrow my copy of Forbidden Archaeology. And I told them, no. I've had too many books end up among the missing. You're not borrowing mine. Now, if you want to, while we're here during the show, you want to go through it, whatever, that's great. But it's not leaving my hot little hands. And it didn't.
Yeah, well, I know how that goes. Yeah, because you give a book out, you forget about it, and then you never see it again.
Yeah, and believe me, I did not want to lose this copy. Now, as promised, let us discuss your more recent book, Human De-Evolution. Tell me, what is that about? I have not read it, Michael.
Well, after I wrote the book Forbidden Archaeology, presenting all this evidence that contradicts the current theories of origins, human origins, people started writing me and saying, okay, if you don't believe what the current theory says, you know, that human beings like us came into existence about 100,000 years ago, having evolved from more primitive ape-like ancestors, then what are you going to propose to replace, you know, the current theory? What ideas do you have? And I thought that was a legitimate question. So I look at myself as being in a dialogue with my readers. So to answer their questions, I brought out this book, Human De-Evolution. And basically what I say in that book is this: before we even ask the question, where did human beings come from, we should first of all ask the question, what is a human being? Now today, many scientists are just going to say, well, a human being is just a combination of chemicals, that's all there is to it. But when I look at all the evidence that comes to us from various fields of scientific investigation, I see there's more to a human being than chemicals. There's a subtle mind element that has some very unusual powers of telepathy and psychokinesis and things like that. And beyond that, there is a conscious self that can exist apart from the body, apart from matter. So what I'm proposing is, just to put it very, very briefly, is that we did not evolve up from matter, from chemicals, as scientists now say. Rather, we devolved or came down from a level of pure consciousness.
So, in other words, even though we are no longer pure consciousness,
we've been covered by matter,
there is still a divine spark?
Yes. And there's evidence for that. For example, there's medical studies of out-of-body experiences. You know, there are times when a person should be completely unconscious, yet many people, you know, for example, who have heart attacks where the blood stops flowing to the brain, medical instruments show that the brain waves stop, they should be unconscious at a time like that. But many people in that condition report separating from their bodies, looking down and seeing what the doctors and nurses are doing. Sometimes also soldiers who are wounded.
Well, you know, Michael, I believe I mentioned this to you all those years ago when I interviewed you before, but I had an NDE. I had a near-death experience in Vietnam. I was severely wounded in 1972. After I was finally transported to the hospital in Da Nang, the 95th Evac, they took me in for surgery then, and I clearly recall, before I had been hurt, I had eaten a ration that morning.
Yeah.
And as a result of the anesthetic that they gave me, I began to vomit. And I literally was choking to death on my own vomit in surgery, and my heart stopped. And, of course, this was all told to me later. But what I do recall was being approximately, and this, honest to God, this happened to me, 15 or more feet in the air looking down on them working on me. I remember that distinctly to this day.
Yes, and there are other soldiers from Vietnam who've reported similar things even before they get to the hospital. Immediately after they've been wounded, they have felt themselves separating from their bodies, looking down, seeing what's happening, seeing the medics coming up to them, trying to get them, you know, back into consciousness. So it's, as I said, this is something that occurs in ordinary medical situations and cases of extreme trauma when people experience automobile accidents, for example, soldiers or policemen being wounded in action. There are many reports. I had an experience like that myself. During the same time that you're talking about, I was in the United States Navy. I was stationed at a weather station in Iceland, and kind of the opposite side of the world, but I had gone with some buddies of mine out into the mountains. We were camping the snowy mountains of Iceland in the middle of winter, and at one night we just had this idea, we'll have a race to the top of the nearest mountain. So, you know, we got out of our tent and we started running up this mountain. It was about 4,000 or 5,000 feet high, covered with ice and no. And I was actually winning. I was getting ahead of my other buddies. And then as I got to the very top, I slipped, and I just started going down that mountain on my back. And I was trying to dig in my heels. I was wearing these kind of like military snow gear, which has kind of like a nylon surface on it. So it's very slick. So I was just going down. I couldn't stop myself. I was just going faster and faster down that slope of that mountain with my head pointed down. I was thinking of all the crevasses, all the sharp rocks, all the cliffs that I had climbed over. And at a certain point, I just let go. You know, I just realized there was nothing I could do to save myself. And I had the experience of floating, separating from my body at that point, looking at myself going down that mountain. Somehow or other, nothing happened. I just hit a snowdrift at the bottom. And I kind of, when I looked up, I could see it was the only path that I could have taken, you know, that would have gotten me down safely.
Boy,
over a cliff or hitting my head on a sharp rock.
Talk about an awakening.
Yeah, but I think, so this kind of evidence suggests to me that there is a conscious self that can separate from the brain, separate from the body. And to me, that means that what's really primary is that conscious self. Like many scientists today would say that the conscious self is just something that arises when chemicals in the brain reach a certain level of complexity, and then you get this thing called consciousness that sort of temporarily begins to arise from those combinations of chemicals, that if you disarrange the chemicals, then there's no more consciousness. You know, it's all just connected with matter. Consciousness, life, comes from matter. Whereas I think it's the opposite, that what's really primary is consciousness, that conscious self, and that it can become temporarily covered and limited by matter.
Well, Michael, we've got to take another break. Hang on, we'll be right back. Okay, we are back. You are listening to Dark Matters Radio. Hey, you know, I've been somewhat remiss. If you're not familiar with Dark Matters Radio, go up, take a look at our website. There's a lot of stuff up there. There's a forum, there's my blog, and a lot of other information. Go to www.darkmattersradio.com and find out just what it is we're doing, what we're all about. Joining me from Southern California, Mr. Michael Cremo, author of Forbidden Archaeology, also Human De-Evolution. We have been having a tremendously fascinating conversation this evening. Michael, are you working on anything right now as we speak?
I'm working on a book now that I'm tentatively calling Forbidden Archaeology 2, because since the first book came out, people have been writing in to me with more cases that they've become aware of, and there are other cases that I've become aware of in other ways through my own research. And it's enough to make a new book. So that's what I'm working on now. Of course, it takes me a long time because I've got to investigate each of these cases very, very carefully. I want to have the best evidence possible in my books, and so that they stand up to the kind of scrutiny that they're liable to get. I have different audiences for my books. I have audiences that are more favorable to these things, and but then there are audiences that are maybe a little bit more skeptical, and they want some of their concerns addressed. So I try to do a careful job in the research and writing, and it takes me a long time. I wish I could write books faster, but that's what I'm working on now.
Well, for what it's worth to not only you but the audience, I am here to tell you that Forbidden Archaeology, when I read it, I absolutely had my entire outlook change. Now, you touched on something. I want to go to your website and read a paragraph to the audience, and I want to get your response to this. The subtitle, and this is on the Forbidden Archaeology page, Scientific Outrage in Response to Forbidden Archaeology. And I'm quoting now. Why has forbidden archaeology generated such intense reactions from the scientific community? One reason is that the book quickly became an underground classic, not only in alternative science circles, but amongst inquisitive seekers in mainstream academia. Its unprecedented comparison of both accepted and anomalous evidence for human evolution stunned scientists by showing that extensive anomalous evidence stands up equally well, if not better, than accepted evidence. After shocking the scientific world, forbidden archaeology caught the general public's attention with the 1996 broadcast of an NBC TV special called The Mysterious Origins of Man. Now, Michael,
yes,
you personally took the brunt of this scientific outrage, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I kind of expected it.
You did?
Yes.
Not the well-mannered, polite questioning of your conclusions, but you ended up basically in some circles as being the... let me see. What would be a good analogy? The Hannibal Lecter of the scientific community.
Something like that.
Would that be in line?
Yes, I found basically within the scientific community three basic reactions to my work from three different groups of scientists. One group I would call, you know, the fundamentalists. I just think they accept the current theories more for political reasons and ideological reasons, purely scientific reasons. I think they accept the current theories because they more or less are in harmony with their prior beliefs in atheism and materialism and things of that sort. So they have a very ideological stance. They don't like what I have to say. They don't want to hear what I have to say. They don't want anybody else.
But they seem to take this absolutely personally, as if you went out and did something unforeseen in their front yard.
Yes. So, and they've tried to, those are the ones that tried to stop NBC from rebroadcasting The Mysterious Origins of Man.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to listen to this very closely. These mainstream scientists did everything in their power to censor what Mr. Cremo had the audacity to point out. And it basically comes to this. Okay, mainstream scientist, this is what I found. This is what I discovered. This is the level this material was in. Now, please explain it. And they acted as if you molested their young daughter, for God's sake.
Something like that, absolutely. And now there's another group of scientists who accept the current theories, but for more or less scientific reasons, which means they're open to hearing alternatives. They're willing to listen to evidence that contradicts their theories. And it's scientists in that group who have invited me to speak at some of the leading scientific institutions in the world, like the Royal Institution in London, the Russian Academy of Science, Department of Anthropology in Moscow, several other academies of science in European countries have invited me to speak. I've also been able to present papers at major international conferences on archaeology and anthropology and history of science. I've also been invited to speak at hundreds of universities around the world. So this group, they are basically supporters of the current theory, but they're open-minded enough to be willing to listen to alternatives and contradicting evidence that's presented in a respectful way. So now some of those who hear me actually come to agree with me. And at the present moment, They are small in number in the scientific world, but that's how these things go. Many of them who do agree with me and support what I'm doing have themselves been victims of this knowledge filtering process at the hands of their colleagues.
Explain that, knowledge filtering. Explain that.
Well, this means that there are scientists who are going to reject any evidence that contradicts the current theory simply because it contradicts those theories. And one excellent example is the work of Dr. Virginia Steen McIntyre, who's an American geologist who I know personally. When she was a young woman just beginning her career in geology, she was involved in dating an archaeological site in Mexico called Hualaco, where some American and Mexican archaeologists had found human artifacts.
I read that account, by the way, Michael.
Yeah, and very ancient layers of rock. So Virginia Steen McIntyre and her colleagues were called down there to date the site. So using four different methods, these geologists came up with an age of 300,000 years for this site. And the archaeologist just said, that's impossible. Human beings capable of making these artifacts didn't exist anywhere in the world 300,000 years ago. And what to speak of being in North America, because according to their current theories, humans didn't enter North America until about 15,000 years ago. So these archaeologists simply just refused to publish the age for the site given by their own hand-picked team of geologists. And Virginia Steen McIntyre was a little bit upset by that, so she independently published the age for the site in a scientific journal. But when she did that, she got a terrible backlash from...
She was blacklisted, wasn't she?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Her reputation was black, and she was called a maverick, a publicity seeker, a troublemaker, partially because of that. You know, she lost a teaching position that she held at a university in the United States, and all of her opportunities for professional advancement were suddenly blocked off, although she was a rising star in her profession until that time.
Well, let me ask you a question. Have you ever pointed out to these naysayers that it's science's job to investigate the unexplained, not explain what is uninvestigated? And if so, how did they respond to that?
Well, you know, they don't always react in a rational way. You know, when I point these things out to some of them, I mean, I was speaking at a university in Brazil in Sao Paulo, and I had been invited by some of the professors at the university to speak, and I made a whole big presentation, you know, about, you know, this work, mentioning all these different cases and all the kinds of things that you're talking about, making those points. And at the end, I could see, well, during the talk, there was this one, I could see this one man in the audience. He was a professor of evolutionary biology, and he was just glaring at me the whole time. So when it came time for questions, he was the first one with his hand up. And he asked me a question, and it just so happened, you know, that I had some slides, you know, in my PowerPoint program that addressed his question. So I went to them, and I, you know, answered his question, and he was shocked, you know, that I had been able to answer his question. And then he just began screaming at me, yelling at me, swearing at me, you know.
Wait a minute.
So this is the kind of reaction that you get sometimes. Other times what happens is at a university in Europe, in Hungary, you know, I'd given a lecture to 700 students and professors, and you know, they all started buying copies of my book and things like that. So some of these naysayers, professors at this university, after I left, they went hunting through the university to find out who in the university, what professor in the university had authorized me to speak there. And they tried to get him removed, you know, from his position. They weren't successful, I'm happy to say, but they tried.
Now, wait a minute, Michael. What you're describing is academic fascism.
It is, and I think there's a larger issue to it. In the United States, at the present moment, only the accepted Darwinian theory of evolution can be taught in the schools, and this is something that has been decided by our government through the judicial system. They allow only one idea to be taught. You cannot even mention any other alternative, and I think it is a kind of intellectual dictatorship that we have now. I think if the current theories were so good, they should be able to stand up, you know, to scrutiny, to criticism, to alternatives. And it's as if the government were telling us, you know, you can only listen to one radio station or only watch one TV station or buy one kind of car or something like that.
Well, you know,
it's something that I think we need a little bit more intellectual freedom in this country.
My most recent experience was something like that. Happened a couple of years ago when I was still active in UFO research. I had been invited to address an anthropology class over at Occidental College here in Southern California. And the professor that had invited me over, and I had spoken to his class on several other occasions, asked me if I would be willing to debate a skeptic, a gentleman by the name of Dr. Michael Shermer. Now, Dr. Shermer...
I know Dr. Shermer.
Yeah.
I know him.
I know, as a matter of fact, I introduced Shermer to the UFO field back in the 90s when I had him on as a guest and to discuss, among other things, the Roswell incident. And Dr. Shermer asked me before the show to please take it easy because he really wasn't that conversant with the subject. Now, he has since become very conversant with the subject. But we began debating the merits of whether there was something to this or not. And he began denigrating a man that I happened to know that had written a bestseller book that was on the New York Times bestseller list for, I don't know, 28, 30 weeks, called The Day After Roswell, Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso.
I've read that book.
Okay. Well, he began claiming that Corso was a fraud, he was this, he was that, and I forced him, before the debate was over, to admit that he had never read Corso's book. Now, the students that were in that classroom were shocked. Here was one of their leading lights, Michael, their leading lights, admitting that he was naysaying something that he had absolutely no evidence of one way or the other. Hey, we got to take a break. We'll be back. Hang on. And we are back. That was our last break. We are almost out of time. My guest this evening, Mr. Michael Cremo, the book, buy it, read it, digest it, Forbidden Archaeology. Go to www.forbiddenarchaeology.com. Michael, we are almost out of time. Now, I know there's so much that we didn't even touch upon, but we're in our last few minutes here. Is there anything that you would like to touch upon before we have to sign off?
The major thing that I would like to see happen is for some diversity to be allowed in our education system for alternative theories about the origin of life in the universe. I think that's one of the most important issues that's facing us, you know, because you know the goals that we set for ourselves individually and collectively are to a large extent determined by you know, the answers that we give to these fundamental questions. Who am I? Where did I come from? And I think the set of answers that we're getting to those questions, which are being dictated to us by the scientists today who have a government enforced monopoly in our education system are the wrong answers. I think they're very materialistic answers. I think we're being told that we're simply robot survival machines whose only purpose is to pass on our genetic material to the next generation, that we're not only simply robot chemical machines, but we're robot chemical machines in competition with each other. These kinds of ideas are responsible for many of the problems that we see in the world today.
Well, don't you think that is one of the reasons that our society and culture as a whole seems to be genuinely devolving?
Yes.
The killings in the street, the media's mindless pap over you know, who is going to a party and not wearing panties, you know, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
It's a real coarsening of our overall society culture, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I think it's dictated. I think what they like to see is that we're simply involved in material production and consumption, that we're producing things, that we're consuming things, and not worrying about anything else. As long as that's going on, then everybody's happy, that we're just some happy little producers and consumers of material things, and just absorbing all the advertisements and doing what's necessary to, you know, keep the economic wheels going. I think that's a very limiting concept of what human life should really be about. And I think we're suffering because of it. I think we see conflict on all levels, conflict among individuals, conflict among families, conflict among classes, conflict among nations, even conflict among religions. I think we see a lot of over-exploitation of the Earth's resources, which leads to a lot of the environmental problems we're having. So I think we need some new answers to these fundamental questions. Who are we? Where did we come from?
Well, before we acknowledge that we need the answers, we've got to acknowledge the questions. And that's, I think, at least in part, what media should be asking. And they're not.
No, they're not. I think we need to put our worldwide human civilization on a new track. And when people talk about change, I think that's the kind of change that's really necessary, not changing one political leader for another.
Exactly. Hey, look, let me ask you, we're almost out of time. How can the audience get in touch if they so desire? Is there a way that they can contact you?
Or yes, if they go to my, you know, my personal website. You mentioned the Forbidden Archaeology website, which they can go to, but there's also my personal website, also mcremo.com, mcremo.com, and they can leave mail for me there. I do see it all. I do reply, and I think that would be and there's also a travel schedule on that website, which would...
Where they can hear you when you're in the area speaking.
Right. If there are any speaking engagements coming up, they would see them there. Or if there are any media appearances coming up, they would also see them there.
Well, Michael, that is it for this edition. I want to take this opportunity to invite you back. Please come back.
Well, let's not make it another 10 years, okay?
Okay. That's it for this edition of Dark Matters. Keep tuning in.